From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Police in Pella Province in Papua New Guinea say they know where to find the tribesmen who took an ExxonMobil employee hostage last Friday. The woman, a scientist, was let go after the police agreed to give in to the men's demand that their kinsman, a local lawyer, be released from detention. The police say all the men were carrying homemade firearms and have gone back to their village. The woman, who was abducted from the vicinity of the Como airfield, built to service ExxonMobil's liquefied natural gas project in PNG. Hela's police commander Michael Wedi told Sally Round the woman was held for about 2 hours before the police managed to resolve the situation.
She was not a local woman. She was somewhere from coast.
In PNG?
In PNG, yes.
So she was an environmental scientist?
Yes, she was.
And the hostage takers, what happened to them?
What happened was that when the suspect who had the firearm in his possession was arrested by the police and was taken into Tari for detention, when the hostage takers went into the camp, got this female employee and held the hostage and demanded that police release that suspect. So my men had to give in to their demand and release the suspect who initially had the homemade firearm on him. We know the suspects involved in this hostage situation. We know the identity. We will have them arrested soon.
Have they gone back to their village?
They have.
So security around the airport, how is that now?
Our police are monitoring the airport. The security is maintained. Police are patrolling the area, and your situation is just normal as like before.
Have you increased security?
Security, yes, we've got our men to, be there full-time now, so security is tight at the airport at the moment. Yeah.
And how would you describe the security situation in general in the province with the elections coming up?
Elections coming up, yes, we are anticipating some problems during elections and perhaps after elections. However, we have also have strategies in place, and I am hoping that the response unit that is going to be deployed into Hela province done soon enough, so that I will then strategically locate them as to the hotspots area that I think we need to maintain for the smooth running of the elections. They should be coming in. I'm hoping that they come in today, tomorrow, at the latest, because what I had was gathered was that they were flown into Hagen on Sunday. And they're gearing up in Hagen at the moment to drive down to Tari.
And how many are there in this response unit?
I'm hoping to get 2 mobile squads and 2 platoons of PNG Defence Force personnel.
And the latest hostage taking, was that election related at all, do you think?
It was not election related. It was an isolated incident. It happened that this suspect was walking around with the firearm, homemade firearm, and was intercepted by the police. And when they arrested him, and then his relative retaliated and then took the female employee hostage.
An economist says Papua New Guineans have lost nearly half of their economic power they had in the 1980s. Paul Flanagan from the Australian National University has worked in PNG and studied the economy there for many years. He said the focus of successive governments on resource development has brought few gains to the people. He says the average Papua New Guinean's economic well-being has fallen dramatically since the 1980s. Mr. Flanagan spoke to Don Wiseman, who began by asking him to defend the term economic well-being.
In this particular case, the specific definition is using the size of the non-resource parts of the economy and putting that in per-person terms. So it's non-resource GDP per capita. This is the best attempt to try and evaluate essentially how an individual's ability to purchase goods and services has changed from 1980 through to 2017, and that number is a very worrying -40.4%.
And in real terms, that means what for your average Papua New Guinean?
So there are obviously distribution elements there. Some people in areas in Port Moresby would have done very well since 1980. But on average, across the country as a whole, it means people in PNG are able to buy less goods and less services relative to 1980. They've gone backwards by 40% in real terms.
And all of this is because of this preoccupation since independence with developing resources or bringing people in to develop resources?
It's the different path between the resource sector, which has done extraordinarily well, and the non-resource sector, which has gone backwards so severely. One thinks the reason for that is a policy emphasis towards the resource sector, favourable taxation policies, favourable decisions as to where to put infrastructure. Just the time and energy of the government is going too much on these great big resource projects, and not enough time on the small holder projects that are good for coffee growers in the highlands, support small-sized businesses in areas such as retail trade and that. Too much focus is going on the big projects, not enough on those smaller projects that would really benefit the people of PNG.
And the people, with their land, this is actually the true resource of PNG as you see it.
It's the land. It's the extraordinary beauty of Papua New Guinea. The untapped tourism potential of the country is extraordinary also. But the real resource are the people themselves, and educating them better, having them more able to engage with the Asian century, being able to tap their potential. That's the area of development policy that is really missing at the moment.
Successive governments have gone for resource development because it's seen like easy money, isn't it?
It does seem as if it's sort of almost money growing on trees, and some of the figures we heard from the current government and their estimates, just how much the tens of billions of dollars they were talking about would be coming through on tax revenues, therefore they could go and do things that led to massive increases in expenditure back in 2013, 2014. It does seem like very, very easy money. The real inclusive development tends to be a much longer path. It's the things that will often take 5 or 10 years to start seeing the results of those type of microeconomic changes that really unleashes the potential of people. We saw that during the 2000s, some of the hard work which was done and the turnaround of the economic mismanagement of 1998-99. But that took, you know, a good 5 years before some of the benefits started being seen from those changes in policies. So it's pretty tempting for a politician to go for those easy money on trees rather than that really hard work on microeconomic reform to build a more inclusive development.
In your report, you do have some focus on Bougainville, and Bougainville, of course, has experienced the highs and the very deep lows as a result of this focus on resources, but they're trying to develop their economy now, and it's still this focus on resource development.
And that's right. Like, there are so many options, and there are so many elements that actually make for successful development. And there isn't a simple silver wand that'll sort of one policy the government can change that will lead to a more inclusive type of development. Bougainville is a case, incredibly complicated. Institutions are weak. Infrastructure is weak. There is still a lot of sort of issues there in social issues to actually be dealt with, including gender issues, to actually build up a more inclusive pattern of development. But to the extent to which the focus moves on, let's just reopen the mine and that'll save Bougainville, that'd be a very worrying, a tempting but very worrying path for Bougainville to go down.
Going into the election, and it's just a couple of weeks' time, do you think what we've heard from any of the political parties is going to lead to a different direction if the O'Neill government doesn't remain in power?
Oh, I think there are. Like, it's obviously a very broad range of parties that are standing. Quite a few of them are talking about sort of more focus on people. They're talking about things of changing some of the tax concessions that might be available. They're talking about even things such as reorientating the big project expenditure on areas such as APEC. And some of the parties are talking quite openly about, we can't afford that sort of thing. We need to put the money back into health and education. These are the sort of priorities. So there's a great range of policies. What I'm hearing from some, and of course the former Prime Minister Murata, who did help with things back in 1999-2000, are putting out policies that once again do suggest sensible approaches towards economic repair, bringing in international partners to assist with that, and getting the focus back on track for a more people-focused development. You see that also, I think, in Pengu Party in some way, some of the people they have there and dealing with institutions and dealing with corruption. There are, I think, some good alternatives there, but obviously the O'Neill government has enormous power in being the incumbent, so the chances of change are very uncertain.
Indonesia's new ambassador to New Zealand says the indigenous population of Papua region is not pushing for independence. Tantowi Yaye says the push for a referendum is coming from overseas-based elements who do not represent the local populace. He says the provinces of Papua and West Papua are governed by ethnic Papuans and that since 2014, Indonesia's government of Joko Widodo has made significant gains in development in the region. The ambassador told Johnny Blaines that Indonesia acknowledges the mistakes of its past and has been working hard to take care of Papuans' human rights.
We understand the perceptions that hangs around, you know, in connections with Papua. For that reason, our police and our military have been doing their job very carefully. So they have been informed and very well trained not to do anything that can abuse human rights. They are very careful.
Okay.
But then the news that spreads to the world are the other way around.
All right. Well, you know, the thing is, the Indonesian human rights body, Kontras, has, well, last year it was saying that it had about 1,200 reports of from Papua, people who suffer from harassment, killings, torture, and other ill-treatment, suggesting that's maybe just the tip of the iceberg. Many of the abuses are by security forces against Papuans who are just trying to exercise their rights to freedom of expression and assembly. That seems to be the persistent area of abuses.
Well, we have to see this issue very, very clearly. I mean, why it happens, for police and for military men, working in Papua is not a safe place. It's not really a safe place.
Why?
Because the way, you know, I can say that the police and the military men and the army, they have been perceived as the representatives of the government of Jakarta. And many times they become the target. That's why in some areas, you know, they don't feel safe. But then, because I have been there many times too, they are still working under what you call it, the ethic of not doing anything that can abuse human rights. So like I said earlier, they have been doing their jobs very carefully, very carefully. But then what can you do? If they are attacked, okay, they have to defend themselves. Now, in the defense, sometimes, you know, there is something bad happens. And this is the kind of thing which is reported to the world as kind of a torture, the torture from the police or the army towards our fellow Papuans. So what happens, in fact, you know, is the other way around. I can say this because, you know, I've been to Papua to see in front of my very eyes what happens actually.
It's interesting what you're saying, because wouldn't there be a reason why people would attack security forces? It doesn't just happen for no reason, does it?
Well, if you ask me frankly, you know, who wants freedoms? I mean, the people of the Papua majority, they love, you know, being with Indonesia. I mean, they are happy with what we have been doing so far. I mean, the development is clear, is now taking place. And after the reformation back in 1998, and then in 2001, we introduced a special autonomy to both of the Papua provinces. And the meaning of the special autonomy is that it's no longer the people outside Papua who governs the two provinces. Since the special autonomy applied, the two provinces of Papua are governed by the ethnic Papuans, okay? 40 regencies and cities, they are all governed by ethnic Papuans, okay? And also the members of the parliaments. And it didn't happen in the past. I mean, if you talk about freedom, they get the freedom now, so to speak.
Governor Enembe, the governor of Papua province. Obviously, he's an ethnic Papuan.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things he's really worried about is transmigration, and it's something that we hear concerns about from a lot of Papuans. You know, I understand the formal process of transmigration isn't necessarily still in place, but there's still a huge influx of people from other parts of the Republic, and it's changing the fabric, isn't it, of Papuan society, and they worry that they're being marginalised. So I guess my question is, why does the government allow that to happen?
We cannot stop the Indonesian who live outside Papua to move into Papua, because Papua is the integral part of Indonesia. I mean, the Indonesian are free to live and work anywhere they want, and because Papua is part of Indonesia, so they can go there. So there is no way government can stop people from moving in, right? But you know what happens today? It's the other way around. It's the people from outside Papua who are marginalized. They cannot become leaders, okay, from the regencies up to the province. There is no way they can do that. And also, in some of the jobs are provided for the ethnic Papuans. One of the few occupation and jobs that the people outside Papua that can do, purely on business level. So they become merchants, they become traders.
But the migrants seem to dominate business in Papua, don't they?
Well, business is something new for Papua people, right? So they need to learn. This is a kind of transfer of knowledge from the migrants to the ethnic Papuans. They need to learn that from the migrants. And I think sooner rather than later, most of the ethnic Papuan people will become a businessman too. So this is the beauty of inviting migrants to live, to work, because at the same time they transfer their knowledge and skill to the local people.
But it is an area of concern for them. So too is, of course, the self-determination issue. Would you agree that the process by which Papua was incorporated into Indonesia still remains a sore point for Papuans? It's behind their calls for a referendum, essentially, isn't it?
Well, this is a kind of emotions and notion which was forced front by those who want freedom for the Papua. But the people themselves, I mean, the majority of the Papuan people living in those two provinces, again, I'm telling you, they're happy with Indonesia. So the issue does no longer exist except by those, you know, who have really agenda, like you said, for, you know, free Papua movement as such. We don't see any issue anymore in regard to the PAPERA or Act of Pre-Choice. Everything was done properly. Everything was done and conducted under the supervisions. Nothing was unclear when the Act of Pre-Choice was exercised. And why it was done in such a way, not one man, one vote, because, you know, those days, it was not possible, you know, to make each and everyone to use his or her constitutional voice to get the vote. And the system, I think, due to the terrains and due to the geographical location, you know, is also taking place in other parts of the world. The result of the PAPERA was then brought to the UN General Assembly, and it was approved. I mean, during the General Assembly of the United Nations, none of the members of the United Nations said no to the process that was happening in the PAPERA.
If there was enough of a groundswell for a referendum, isn't that democracy to give people a voice about how they want their
Johnny,
political
status? Why should we talk about referendum if you know the result of the last presidential elections? Over 60% of the Papuan people voted for Jokowi. It means that he wants Jokowi to become the president and preside the people of Papua. If you talk about referendum, you're talking about yourselves. If it comes from your people, then probably it can be accepted by the government. But here the voice of referendum is not coming from the Papuan. they are Papuan who live abroad, and they are no longer Indonesians.
Now, to a story that we have been paying attention to for the past few months, media freedom has come under the spotlight in Tonga ever since the Prime Minister threatened the public broadcaster over his dissatisfaction of their reporting. The government has since fired the board chair and the general manager of the Tonga Broadcasting Commission, the latter of which is now before the courts. Koro Wakawato reports.
They have become an enemy of government. They claim the freedom of media should be allowed, should be the same with any other media in Tonga. But they should understand there's a basic difference between a private media and also government media. Their main role, to me, is to facilitate the work of the government.
Those were the comments that signalled a growing rift in the relationship between Mr. Pōhiwa and the Tonga Broadcasting Commission, the TBC. A consultant with the TBC says the comments and threats to allow another company to take over its services affected its news coverage. The TBC chair and general manager were also sacked. Laumanu Petelo says staff were initially intimidated.
As to changing our stories to focus more on things that will be positive to government rather than getting stories that are balanced and unbiased. And so we felt that we were kind of changing our roles to trying to fit in to what the Prime Minister and government wanted.
However, Ms. Petelo says she feels with court proceedings and media coverage of the affair, things are starting to improve. The Acting General Manager, Mele Kamoto, says uncertainty remains.
Oh, I'm sort of, if I can say, unbalanced myself, because you don't really know what's the future of TBC. And what would that be the effect, especially on us management staff?
New chair Ahungalo Fusimalohi says it's his job to clean up the TBC's act in terms of revenue and infrastructure, but also in terms of news coverage.
There can be no political interference, which is guaranteed under our constitution, and the government is wary of that. But to say, label us an enemy, they're actually referring to some news pieces that they believe is not correct, and I have to look into it.
Mr. Fusimalohi says he's reviewing the TBC from top to bottom. Meanwhile, prominent publisher Kalafi Moala says the saga has impacted the whole media landscape.
You've got media that have kind of moved back to a position where their criticism of government or government policy is kind of being softened up. And then you have media that have crossed the line and gone over and become a government puppet. There's been a culture of fear in media. And it's not a fear of just media freedom. It's a fear that if government doesn't support them, they're going to go down financially. Government is still the biggest advertiser in the country.
However, chair of the Tonga Media Council, Pese Funua, says while he doesn't condone the Prime Minister's actions, he says life goes on for other media. Mr. Funua says there's always been a split of pro- and anti-government media outlets in Tonga.
It's almost like a party politics. Party's paper, they support this and they support that. But they still have a benefit in a way, that's how I look at it. And I mean, it's up for you what you want to read, but you have all different views. So if you look at it squarely, you can have a good coverage of what's happening.
Mr. Funua also says nowhere has news coverage like Nuku'alofa, where he says there are five newspapers to cater for a population of about 40,000. But a political researcher believes the media saturation may be problematic.
You see certain media outlets siding with this government, and the previous governments had a whole lot of different allies in the media. And so we lose the integrity of information. So no wonder the electorate, the communities, is in tatters and confused.
Akalisi Pōhiwa has indicated he believes the TBC feud is over. However, former general manager Nanase Fifita is currently before the courts seeking reinstatement. This is Koro Wakauta.
And finally on the program, the impact of digital technology on the Samoan language has been debated as part of a recent Language Week and Samoan Independence celebrations in Auckland, New Zealand. Students and community members voice their opinions on whether the Samoan language has any use in today's globalized world. We have this report from Sarah Viatulu.
AET Professor of Pacific Studies Tangaloa Telepi Fairburn Dunlop says that it's not so well understood that technology impacts on the quality of family life. She says it is important to stay culturally connected in this day and age.
There are so many celebrations and it's so important to lift up the language and reconnect to one's cultural roots as we celebrate 55 years of Samoan independence.
Then two teams took the stage at the AUT Manukau campus debate to argue for and against the moot question on whether the Samoan language has relevance in today's contemporary society. Father Michael Alapia Engdeman, who gave a blessing over the event, says the language is important.
When you talk using the Samoan language, firstly, people will sit up and listen to you. And secondly, people are happy to talk to you. And thirdly, you can have your say to other people. And if you speak well, then people will ask, whose daughter's that? Or whose son is that? Where do they come from? Who are their family? Where do they go to school?
Lemoa Henry Fesuluai says that many Asian cultures do well and staunchly maintain their first language.
How can you say that the Asians don't value language? It's valued by the Chinese, Japanese and Koreans, and that's why their languages are first. Their cultures are thriving.
Hoi Nang Wong Soon says that Māori people have similar struggles with language retention, but at times it just comes down to attitudes.
There's this Māori Samoan doctor, Agnes McFarland, who works at MIT nearby the train station, and she did her research on the Māori language, and she said, you are the boss of your own language, write it down.
Sunny Ngāti Niu says the Samoan Te Tau is a different type of language.
So for everything there is a genealogy. So for a Te Tau there is a genealogy. So genealogy is the most important thing to say that you are Samoan. Other things that you say are Samoan are respect, service, care and te olewa, or space. These are all things written on the body.
The winner on the night was the affirmative side, which argued that the Samoan language still has much use and value in today's globalised world.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to let us know how you heard the program, do so by sending an email to us at focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.